The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Okay, we are going to finish by 12, hopefully, and then we will be finished with the world of Islam. Then we're going to go into Islam in America. Hopefully, I sure hope we have enough time for this. Yeah, I think, we're going to look at, I'm going to show you I'm trying to decide if I should, where I should put the videos. There's a video of Jihad in America, one that I want to show you. And by the way, when we do this thing, does this thing S video? Is that the deal?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay. We're going to look at a timeline here, Islam versus the West, to kind of put some things into perspective, okay? And again, you hear Muslims coming at you, and saying, that you gotta repent for the Crusades and all that kind of stuff. Now, if you remember, going back to the very beginning, the key battles of Muhammad, remember these? The Battle of Badr, remember the Muslims were victorious, remember we looked at the life of Muhammad?
Mm-hmm.
What was the next one, the Battle of what? Come on, you ought to know this. The Battle of Uhud. All right. The Muslims were defeated. And the Battle of?
Ditch.
The Ditch, that's right. Did I tell you about Saddam, Gulf War I, what he did? Did I tell you about that? Well, what Saddam did during Gulf War I, he did two things. And again, we don't think religiously, all right? The war is getting ready to break out, and Saddam, he digs this ditch, halfway around Kuwait City. Digs this ditch. Alright? Now, in the Muslim mind, it said, this is the Battle of the Ditch. Why? Because the Battle of the Ditch was, what kind of warfare was that? Come on.
Psyops.
Alright? Remember the sandstorm came and blew the stuff away and all that? Alright? And Saddam said, this is going to be the mother of all battles and the blood is going to run, all that. You see, he was using an imagery. And he was electrifying the rest of the Islamic world. And then the thing that got it is that he went to the mosque and you can see him praying. And he said, I saw a vision. And Muhammad told me that I should stand fast or something like that. Well, boom, he got all the Muslim world behind him. Because, you see, visions and dreams and things, those are very, very important from an Islamic point of view. As a matter of fact, there's a lot of Muslims who come to Jesus because Jesus appears to them in dreams and stuff. And so, the whole Muslim world just got electrified. Boom! okay. And so, but see, we in the West, we didn't think much of it. Anyway, so it just gives you, see, if you know these things and you see things happening and everything, it's like he's appealing. He knew what he was doing. And Saddam isn't any more Muslim than I am. He wasn't any more of a Muslim than I am. Okay, there you go. I keep forgetting that he's gone. But anyway. All right. So, those are the battles. Now, Muhammad's military victories had two results, had two basic results. One, they attracted many new converts to Islam. Remember I told you that? How many were the Meccan forces during the Battle of the Ditch? There were 10,000 of them. The Muslims numbered 3,000. Well, right after that battle, most of those 10,000 converted to Islam. Why? Because they had a choice between the what?
The sword.
Strong horse and the weak horse. Okay? And that led to, of course, you remember he did that thing with the Jewish man? And, again, of course, since so many more became Muslim, they strengthened Muhammad's power. That's why, when he signed the treaty with the merchants of Mecca, he suddenly, he only had 3,000. Suddenly, he came to town with 10,000. You got it? Just he gained 7,000 followers just like that. So it had these two effects. Now after Muhammad's death in 632 A.D., the caliphate was established to rule the Muslims. You know that, right? All right. Who was the first caliph? Abu Bakr. Right. All this kind of, Now Abu Bakr. He begins the conquest of the Arabian Peninsula. All right. He initiates the Ridda Wars. Now the Ridda Wars were waged against those Muslims who had fallen away. Because after the death of Muhammad, a lot of Muslims fell away from Islam. You know, they said, well, you know, the old man's dead, you know, while the cat's away, the mice will play, or whatever, you know. So Abu Bakr then launches a war to recapture them, all right? Right, it was a revival. There it is. All right. And so since the Ridda Wars, the entire Arabian Peninsula has been Islamic territory, all right? All right, now, Umar, remember the second caliph? Umar, whatever. Some people spell it Umar. I should be consistent. I should make it Umar. But anyway, he began to expand the Muslim territory beyond Arabia. Now, In those early days, you know, Islam couldn't spread that fast except by military means, okay? So the Muslim armies moved out to Arabia against the two surrounding territories. What were they? The Persian Empire. Remember, the Persians were the Sassanids, remember? And the Byzantine Empire. They are the ones who were supposed to have been Christians, but they were Christians in name only. All right. So they're on the move. All right, so you know, looking at this early stuff. So here we go. We're going to look at how they conquered. Okay, now let's look at the Byzantine Empire. Okay, in AD 527, there was the extent of the Byzantine Empire. So it stretched down into Egypt and so forth and so on. All right, and then later on, by the time of Muhammad's death, 632, the Byzantines had spread up further up here and taken over. Sicily and so forth and so on. Okay, so now that's the extent of the Byzantine Empire. Okay, now 632 is the death of Muhammad. So watch this now. Right after that, we start having Muslim expansion. Okay, so check this one out. By 632, I made a mistake just now. By the time of Muhammad's death, the entire Arabian Peninsula had been under Islamic control. Okay. All right. Like I said, there were some people who turned away, and of course, Abu Bakr brought them back in. Now, watch this. Watch the expansion now. By 662, in 30 years, they expanded. They cut into the Byzantine Empire, right? And they've taken over much of northern Africa, down into Egypt. All right? That's in 30 years. Okay? All right. And then, of course, All right. There we go. By 750, by the time you have the emergence of the Umayyad dynasty, you have Muslim expansion all the way up through Spain. All right. The Byzantine Empire is coming apart and all the rest of that. And, of course, by this time, things are starting to happen. What's happening in Europe? They see all this happening. They say, oh, we've got to get religion. And they started... No. All right. So, especially by, but that was a threat. You know, it was beginning to move. So that's Muslim expansion within, say, the first 100 plus years. Okay, and most of that expansion was military. I might say that some of these folks here who are the Byzantines, the Muslims came. You know, the real Christians who are under the Byzantines, they found the Muslim conquest to be a relief, because the Byzantines were persecuted. Okay. So there we go. So now let's talk about it. Here we go. The surrounding territories fell very quickly. Damascus in 634. Syria, 636. Jerusalem, 638. See? Rapid succession. Egypt, 642. All right. These are all the territories that fell. All right. Persian Empire. They reached the Persian Empire in 652. Carthage, 697. India. They reached India, 711. 7-Eleven. I wonder if they stopped and got a sandwich. All right, and then they conquered Spain by 713. All right, and it's at about this time when you begin to see the looting, pillaging, raping, stealing, burning on the part of Islamic Jihad. And here, for example, in Rome, the churches of Saint Peter and Saint Paul were looted. All right. I mean, Christendom was under attack. You know, all kinds of atrocities are happening. People are put to the sword to say, you submit to Allah or die, that kind of thing. This is Islamic Jihad, and it's happening. It's kind of rough. Okay, so Europe was surrounded until it began the counteroffensive. That's why the Crusades happened. See, it wasn't Christendom deciding to just out of thin air going and beat up on some Muslims. You see, they were responding to Islamic Jihad. Can I give you a little funny little deal? The Mafia, as we know it, was originally an Islamic invention. You know, the Don is the Caliph. So when they took over Sicily, they ruled Sicily for a while. And everybody had their little fiefdoms and stuff like that. You had this little caliph and so forth and so on. And everybody. And when the Muslims left Sicily, those organizations still stayed around. And of course, the caliphs became the godfathers. And the rest is history. Okay. All right. All right. So here go the invasion routes, the actual invasion routes that they. Here's the boundaries of the. The Eastern Roman Empire, that just kind of got obliterated, okay? Okay, so there they go. They go out from Medina, and they go up into Tarsus, and across North Africa, and on down. And of course, where was the Muslim advance stopped in Europe?
Vienna?
Yeah, well, Tours, And then, of course, Vienna, the Viennese, They were surrounding them and all that, and they made these croissants, kind of like that. There you go. All right. So those are to kind of make the Muslims think that they were kind of with them. That's cool. This is interesting. You ever watch? You ever wonder why Russian churches have that onion thing on top? That was partly due to the influence of Islam. Okay, it's an architectural influence. As a matter of fact, our pointed arch comes from.
Were you saying the shape of a croissant?
It was the crescent, you see. It was a way of saying, oh, we're on your side, we're with you, All right, so. So it's interesting, these things. Okay, so in 732, then, the advance, the Muslims are defeated in Tours. Let me say this, and I said it earlier to a group of people who were standing up here. Here's something to think about, okay? Now, please. Don't go out here quoting me saying that I think we should put Muslims in the gun or anything like that. But in the history since Islam has been here, the only way Islam has ever been defeated has been militarily. Okay? That's the only way it's ever been defeated. All right, we wrestle not against flesh and blood and all that. I know, But I'm just saying that, okay? That's an observation. My mentor told me that. I said, "You're not right." He said, "Then do the history." And I did it. I looked into it, and sure enough, the only way Islam has ever been defeated is militarily. All right. So, Battle of Tours, 100 years after the death of Muhammad, the Muslims were defeated. All right. This is the first real setback, for the Muslims in Western Europe. If it hadn't been for that, then Notre Dame would have had the moon and the crescent on it, and minarets all around it. Okay. All right. So here we go. The Spanish balance of power then shifts by 1034. You begin to shift back towards the Catholics. Okay? Or back towards the Christians. Okay, the Muslim Empire became divided and weak. the Muslim conquest kind of burned out. And I'm suggesting to you that perhaps, just maybe, perhaps, the current resurgence in Islam might peter out that way too. All right? And I'm hoping that this next time, that if we defeat it, you know, that it won't be militarily, it'll be by the fire of the word, okay? All right. So, came under attack from the Turks, all right? And remember, because the Turks were still under the Byzantines at the time, okay? The Christian Europe began to rise in prosperity. Now, why did it kind of start rising in prosperity? Later on, okay, remember, the Muslims had a very strong economic stronghold in world trade. You know that? Because they controlled the Silk Road, and that was the way that, you know. So you go over to India and you buy some curry. Okay, give me a bottle of curry like this, it cost me $2. Right? But by the time I got back to Paris with the curry, having paid all those tolls and all those fees and stuff to get through on the Silk Road, I had to sell, you know, of course I had to make my profit, right? So I'm going to sell it for $4. That's what I intend to sell it for. But I got to cover my cost. So by the time I get to Paris, I got to sell it for $350. Because those are the tolls and stuff and right? Those are the expenses of bringing you here. Now, I'm bringing curry to Paris. I'm bringing curry to Italy. Okay, and I'm spending, people are spending all this money. Now, my competitor says, well, if I can undercut him, I can beat Ellis at his own game if I can sell my curry for cheaper. But how do you make it cheaper?
Bring somebody to Paris.
Huh?
Bring somebody to Paris.
That's right, bring somebody to Paris, right? Okay, but how do I get it here cheaper? Okay, how do I, if I can only figure out a way so I don't have to pay those tolls.
You got to control the
road. Yeah. So in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Why did he sail the ocean blue? He was looking for an alternative trade route. You see, you got
interesting,
it.
Interesting. Yeah.
Okay. All right. And it was later on. You see, it was later on that the Islamic, the Muslim, whatever, the Muslim establishment. They began to get weak, okay? First of all, they burned out militarily, and then they started getting a little weaker economically because as the Europeans began to discover these sea routes, now, it's kind of like today, if all of a sudden we discovered that we could put aspirin in water and make gasoline. What if that happened? You know, I think the resurgence... This resurgent Islam will be stopped in its tracks in about 10 to 20 years if we find an alternative. You understand? Because suddenly they wouldn't have the money to carry out all that stuff. Now you can't go to a mosque and have them give you a Quran. So you begin to see the decline of Islam. Yes?
Right now, the European Union, a lot of Europe, they are turning toward Islam, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, not yet. The younger folks and the late workers and stuff, they're Muslim.
Also, but in a few years, getting stronger and U.S. dollar is getting weaker.
Right.
So if U.S. loses the economic strength, then I think it would be...
Yeah.
That kind of situation.
Yeah, the balance will go back, right?
Right.
But what if we found, and you see again, and I don't understand these people, these American oil people, and they're so bent on short sighted. If I owned Exxon Mobil or whatever, I'd be really looking into alternative energy, you know. But they think they want to make a quick buck. They want to get their retirement and and walk away with a $200 million bonus. You understand what I'm saying? But I'm thinking ahead. All right. So anyway, that's it. Don't get started on some of this stuff. All right. So 1096, the Crusades began. Okay. Remember, the Crusades were a counteroffensive. Okay. Now understand. Did atrocities happen? Yes, they did. The Crusaders committed many atrocities. But you understand, it would not have happened. It was a response to Islam and Jihad. And that's what the, our Muslim friends keep forgetting to tell us. All right. All right. It was, oh, by the way, they burned the Holy Sepulchre, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem and all the rest of that. That was the trigger. That was the, you know, that was the straw that broke the camel's back, okay? All right. Christians were being persecuted and all the rest of that. And, of course, again, Europe felt under siege. You know, Europe was encircled, right? They had come up through Spain and they had come up through the Balkans. Okay. So, the Crusaders attempted to gain the lands that were lost for the Muslims. And that's why, you know, and of course, that included the Holy Lands and all that. Okay. So, 1492. The last Muslim city in Spain falls. And it's interesting, that's the year that Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Okay, it's interesting. So, you see, so he goes to Queen Isabella. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
And Isabella. And
she says, yes, yeah, right. And she says, now, like Arsenio Hall used to say, I think this boy's got an idea here, right? Because she sees now. She sees that Spain can, well, anyway. But see, all these years I've been studying this history, and I never knew the role that Islam played in all of this, okay?
Yeah.
So the Muslims were completely defeated in the fall of Granada, and the Catholic king of Castile, you know, was victorious, all right? And so this ended 8 centuries of Islamic rule in Spain. Okay. All right, Treaty of Granada was ratified. It had 67 articles providing for the tolerance of Muslims left in Spain. Okay, there was the initial tolerance, okay. But then guess what? Muslims repeatedly rebel against Spanish authority. Why? Okay, now put your thinking caps on.
It's not an Islamic government.
That's right. Therefore, it has no right to rule Muslims and all the rest of that. So that's why. And so they were exiled, okay. They were given a choice between conversion to Christianity or exile from Spain. You know, a lot of Muslims converted too. Alright? Interesting. Alright.
So that was the genesis of the Inquisition?
Yes, that was the Inquisition. That's right. The Inquisition was mainly against Islamic, you know, against the Muslims. But the Jews got caught up in
it.
Alright. Alright. So the Muslims are defeated in Vienna. This is where you have a Poussin deal. Okay. Alright. 1529 through 1623, the Muslims are defeated there, and the Muslims are defeated in Malta by 1565. If that hadn't happened, then the Muslims would have still controlled the eastern Mediterranean and all the rest of that, okay? So, they took the control of the Mediterranean away from the Muslims. You see, they had a chokehold on it, you see? And alright. So, a Muslim victory, there it is. The Muslims would have regrouped, and it would have led to the fall of Europe had they not done that. Okay. All right. Now, here we go. Okay, the Muslims then decide to regroup. Okay, they're defeated all over the place, but they all, you know, by 1300, the Turkish warriors then began to conquer territory. The Turks, remember? All right. Remember, the Turks were at the time. Well, there were some. By this time, you have Islam occurring in Turkey. And by the way, when did Constantinople fall? 1214. I can't think of it. Anyway, that was the last stronghold of Christianity in Turkey. All right. So now you have the beginning of the Ottoman Empire. Okay, the Ottoman Empire founded by Osman Gazi. All right. Remember, I talked about. Muhammad and the Caliphs, you know, remember that?
Yeah.
And after the Abbasid dynasty, then the Ottomans take over. So now you have, you know, the time of guys like Suleiman and all these people. Okay. Although expelled from Europe, the Muslims considered their rule of the territories, in Africa and the Middle East, so they consolidated what they had. So they're regrouping. And like I said, they come under the Asia, that means Western Asia, okay? By the end of the 14th century, then, the Ottoman Empire was one of the most important and powerful empires of the time. So the Ottomans then, you know, they consolidated around the Ottoman dynasty. Okay. All right. So here we go. So we're going to look at the Ottoman Empire, the various stages of its growth, okay? In the early days, there it was. 1359, that was the extent of the Ottoman Empire, okay? And then it expands by 1520, it expands that far, okay? And then, of course, by 1683, the Ottomans expand across North Africa, so they consolidate their whole all over. And so they were defeated, but then they regrouped, and then they regained, and they consolidated their whole there. And that's the way things were until, well, they lost some of that land, but of course, in 1923, remember, when Turkey emerges as a secular state. And by that time, the Ottoman Empire had shrunk again. It was disbanded by the secular Turks. And the Muslim radicals today consider that to be a great setback, you know, because they don't like to be ruled by secular folks. It's got to be Islamic. All right, so that's just a little bit of a timeline to kind of give you. Now, I'm working on the other timeline. There's another one that takes you from 1383 all the way up to 1923. I'm working on that, okay? But it's so much information. I'm trying to narrow it down and truncate it a bit. Okay, any questions on that? All right, this next one we'll get into, and we might be a little late for lunch, but I'll make leeway for it. Yeah?
When those guys conquered, were they all like under the Islamic law?
Yeah. Well, again, they remember they conquered these places and they adopted customs and philosophies, you know, so forth and so on. But yeah, they were under Islamic law. But Islamic law had not been fully as developed then as it is now. You see, Islamic law was still developing.
So it wasn't like the Greek Empire where it was kind of they're incorporating conquered culture.
To some extent, yes. Because that's why you had the growth of the Hadith, that they were incorporating system, things out of other philosophical systems and stuff. And that's why they had to sort that out. But you'll see in this next piece, during all this time, there are influences among the Muslims, especially from Greek philosophy and stuff like that. You begin to see them wrestling with some of these ideas. What's the relationship between revelation and reason? And what's the relationship between hadith and Quran? And is there human free will or is it divine determinism? They start wrestling with these things as these conquests are happening, you see. Because they're running into other situations and you're seeing the growth of the hadith and all the rest of that. Okay? All right. It's kind of a dynamic situation. Okay, we'll get to this. By the way, we're not talking about radical terrorists anymore now. So you can unbuckle your seatbelt. Okay, all right. I'm going to try to finish this. Some of this I'll skim over, but this is kind of a fascinating thing here. And I'm still working on this. This is really really complicated, but I'm trying to simplify it for you. Okay, all right. Okay, first of all, okay, the development of Sunni Kalam. Kalam is an interesting thing, okay? Kalam roughly means speech in Arabic, or the word, okay? Jesus is called the word of God in the Quran, okay? The first technical use of this term, there it is, Kalam Allah. Kalam Allah. Kalam Allah. Okay, or the speech of Allah, or the word of Allah, okay? That's the first time we hear that. Okay. All right. First technical use of the word. And there it is. It's right out of the Quran. Can ye, O ye men of faith, entertain the hope that they will believe in you, seeing that a party of them heard the word of Allah and perverted it knowingly after they have understood it? Surah 2. 75, verse 75. Okay, so that's the. All right, Kalam Allah, word of Allah. So speech is a quality of Allah. Okay, sifa rather. sifa. And thus, Allah's speech is uncreated. It's a quality, sifa. You know, it's uncreated. You see where you get the idea of the uncreated eternal tablet. Right? Okay. The uncreated eternal tablet. This is the basis for the Islamic concept. Okay, like I said. Alright, now. And we know that's the origin of the Quran, right? Kalam was also used in reference to the Quran. Sometimes they would refer to the Quran as Kalam. Kalam, Kalam. Well, that's the way we refer to the Bible, right? Okay. All right. Now, as Islam developed, Kalam slowly became the name for theology. All right. Now, I'm trying to help you understand how Islamic thought kind of developed. And we're going to go over, now we're following the Sunni path. We're not talking about the Sufis at this point. All right? All right. So, in early Islam, Kalam was viewed as having two sides. Kalam was viewed as having two sides. Fiqh, or intelligence, that was the speculative side, canon law, things like that. And the other was ilm, which is information, the traditional side. So understand, you've got fiqh and ilm. Fiqh and ilm. You're going to see this come up again, okay? Fiqh and ilm. Okay. Later in Islam, Kalam came to be called the greater fiqh. Remember, fiqh, the speculative side, canon law. Kalam became known as the greater fiqh. Eventually, Kalam came to refer to speculative theology, and fiqh came to refer to as canon law. So you had Kalam, speculative theology, and fiqh, canon law. So they divided, okay? All right. Now, Kalam did not develop systematically in Islam. All right? The theology didn't develop systematically. That's the one advantage that we as Christians have. When we dialogue with Muslims, we have systematic theology we can fall back on, and they don't have it, okay? It arose in response to specific historical situations, socio-political debates. Well, you know, all theology arises in situations like that. But we have systematic theology. Why? Because we can question and we can use our minds, and et cetera, et cetera. And it's important for Christians to understand what's there. But you'll see in Islamic things, that's not important. So, according to Muslims, this is what Muslims say. They say, Christian theology seeks to answer the question, what should we believe about particular things? All right? And of course, that's orthodoxy, right? This is what the Muslims say. All right. The Muslims say, Kalam seeks to answer the questions, what must we do in particular situations? So you see the emphasis on doing, okay? And they call their thing orthopraxis, all right? Now, faith and action, okay, they say faith and action are intertwined in Islam. That's what they say, all right? And you cannot have faith without action, and what? Faith and actions are under the guise of Allah. Now, that's the way the Muslims see it. Now, is that really true? I don't think so. Now, I try to work out something that resembles the biblical view here. Okay. The Bible provides more than adequate foundation for both faith and works. All right? The Bible provides more than adequate foundation for faith and works. All right. So what is the foundation? The foundation is gratitude to God for His saving grace. Is that right? It's gratitude to God for His saving grace. And this gratitude is governed by two expressions. Two expressions of gratitude. One is faith, basically our response of trusting Christ and his saving grace. And the other is works, the resulting demonstration of our faith and our thanksgiving to God for His saving grace. So that's it's gratitude. Gratitude then becomes, you know, in the, what is it, in the, the Heidelberg Catechism. I don't know. Okay. Forgive me for being a heretic here. But I like the Heidelberg Catechism better than I do the shorter one. I kind of raise my kids on that one, you know. Okay. But in the Heidelberg Catechism, it talks about, you know, what? Guilt? What's the good news? You know? Guilt? What? God's grace? And then our gratitude, right? Guilt, grace, and gratitude. All right, so you have those two foundations. Now, there are two expressions. These two expressions of gratitude are empowered by two motivations. A salvific motivation for faith. So if you're salvifically motivated, then that faith becomes the expression there. And what do I mean by salvific? Our ongoing strong desire to grow in our knowledge and experience of God's salvation. But what about works? There's a doxological motivation for works. All right? An ongoing desire to show the excellence of God's glory. All right, so when I want to glorify God, it's works. When I think in terms of salvific, you know, it's faith. All right, but both of those are important. Okay, you can't have if you got one. What is it? John Murray said it. How did John Murray say it? We're saved by faith alone, but not a faith that is alone. Is that right? All right. So the motivation for. So if we are salvifically motivated, then faith has high value. If we are doxological, or I should say when we are doxologically motivated, then works has high value. So this is behind what Jesus says. He says, let your light so shine. See, this becomes the visible thing. So that others may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. See it? Now, so as Christians, we have the motivation for both. And if we are fully functional, both salvifically and doxologically, then we will have both results. We will have faith and works. I think I learned this one here. The Roman Catholic view of that is faith plus works yields salvation. Okay. All right. The fundamentalist view is faith minus work yields salvation. Right? And the biblical view is faith. And I understand, maybe I should just say gratitude. Well, I'll just say faith. This is what they told me. Yields salvation plus works. All right. So I took that and I modified it. All right. So the Muslims, you see, they don't understand, you know, these guys, and that's why it's so important. That's why Reformed theology becomes so key. You know, if we're gonna win the day, it's gonna have to be, you know, Reformed theology, because we've got our stuff is strong. We got it together here. Okay, all right. So Christians have called theology the queen of the sciences, but Muslims have called fiqh the queen of the sciences, canon law. Okay, all right. So that's what the Muslims will say, and again. This is one of the things that becomes very effective when I dialogue with them. I say, no. Here's the deal, and I hit that gratitude thing. But you see, again, the Muslims, what are they doing? They're trying to work. They're trying to earn something. They're trying to earn their salvation. And I'm telling them, my whole life is all about gratitude for what God has done for me. All right. So those are just some initial thoughts. So now let's go down the path of the development. Islamic thought. Okay. Alright. The path of Sunni Kalam. Okay, here we go. Alright. In the early days of Islam, you had two parties that emerged. The Kharijites and the Murajites. Alright? Kharijites and the Murajites. So who were they? Alright. Alright. Here was the Kharijite heresy. This is what they said. The Kharijites came along, and these are the things they said. First of all, it emerged during the caliphate of Ali. Okay, remember? Remember I gave you that history? All right. And they saw Kalam as a way of determining who qualifies to be a Muslim. And they demanded a total and complete observance of all the pillars and articles of Islam. Who does that sound like? Those are the Islamic extremists today. You see, the Islamic extremists. And if you want to understand that, I think I get ahead of myself. I think I say this here, that the Islamic extremists have, in essence, bought into the Karajan heresy. All right. So here are their basic assertions. Ali should have been the first caliph after Muhammad. That's what they said. Of course, they agree with the Shiites at that point, right? And here's another thing they said. Faith equals works. Faith equals works. If your acts are not good, then your faith is not good. Here's another one. If a person fails in the smallest detail to perform all the duties of Islam, then he is kufr. Okay, he is accursed. Okay. All right. He deserves to die. All right. And his fellow Muslims have the right to kill him. You see this? So if you're not perfect in everything, then you're not a true Muslim. All right. So when Ali became the caliph, they expected him to denounce the three previous caliphs before him. But he didn't do it. He's kind of laid back about it, right? So, you know, more easygoing, right? The Karajites wanted him to say, oh, these guys aren't legitimate. But he's more easygoing. So what does that mean? That's right. He's not the real deal. So eventually, the Karajites wanted to declare jihad against Ali. And it is my suspicion that either those who became Sunnis who didn't want to see they elected Ali, but these Karajites are the ones probably who might have been behind the assassination of Ali. I don't know. All right. Now, there we go. Radical fundamentalists, they've embraced the Karajite heresy. Again, that's why Sadat was killed, because he violated Islamic teaching by making concessions to the Jews, and thus he was kufr. You see the reasoning?
Yeah.
So now that's where this Islamic jihad, this Islamofascism comes from. It comes from the Karajite heresy. And again, which goes back to something that I said earlier. If they win the day, we're going to go back to the 7th century. You understand what I'm saying? This is where they are. All right, now you had the Karajites. Now you had the Murajites, on the other hand. The Murajites. So what was their deal? All right, so you have the split. Okay, they disagreed with the Karajites' demand for strict and absolute observance of Islam and Islamic law. To resolve the question as to who was a real Muslim and who was not, they referred to the what? Day of Judgment. They said, let Allah solve this and sort that out. Okay? So here are their basic assertions. Only Allah can judge sinners. Faith does not equal works. Faith is not the same thing as works. All right. Bad acts do not automatically mean bad faith. And fail to perform one part of Islam does not necessarily mean one is kufr. So you see, they're much more gracious, aren't they? All right. He does not deserve to die. And his fellow Muslims do not have the right to kill him. All right. So you have the 5 points of Karajites versus the 5 points of the Murajites, right? Okay. All right. Okay. Faith, not acts, determines membership in the Islamic Ummah. All right. Only Allah knows your faith, not humans. Good people with good faith can't have bad acts. So that takes you off the hook, doesn't it? All right. Now, the Murajites are the ones who divided the world up into two basic groups. Dar al-Islam or Dar al-Salam, okay? Dar al-Islam, the house of Islam, or Dar al-Salam, the house of peace. And of course the other is Dar al-Haq, the house of war. Now, let's put your thinking caps on now. You know who, the house of Islam, you know who that is. Those are the believers, right? Those are the believers. And Dar al-Haq, the house of war, those are the non-believers. So if it's the house of war, what does that mean? It means that there is perpetual jihad against Dar al-Harb, because it is the house of war. Perpetual jihad. And understand, that's how these radical Muslims think. Alright. Well, the majority of Sunnis accepted the Murajai position and rejected the Karajai position. So that was the first. So you had the first big thing. Remember, you know, the first big deal, the first big battle. So the Murajites won the day. The Karajites were defeated. Alright. And don't worry, there's coming a diagram for all this stuff. Okay, so the majority of them accepted. Now, what are the political ramifications of the Murajite position? Well, guess what? The Umayyad dynasty often appealed to the Murajite position. Because, you know, when you get into dynasties, you know, the first guy might be great, but the next guy, you know, may be awful. You know, everybody likes Queen Elizabeth, but Prince Charles, I don't know. There's a whole lot of people who wanted to skip over to William, you know, so, okay. All right, now, so when you have a dynasty like that, you're bound to have some bad apples in that bunch, all right? People who aren't consistent. And so when Muslims will say, hey, you're not being consistent, you're doing bad acts, that's not fair, remember, bad acts do not always mean bad faith. You have no right to judge me. You see? And so they used the Umayyads used the Murajite position to justify their staying in power. So they justified their positions by that. All right. Okay. Now, here's what the Umayyad rulers pronounced. This is what they said. You have no right to judge us and lead rebellions against us. I don't care how bad we get, all right? If your judgment and rebellion are mistaken, then you will go to hell. See? All right. Our positions and actions are foreknown by Allah. They're foreknown by Allah. And Allah has determined our position and authority. So it's like the divine right of kings. Allah put us here. See, you have no right to question us. All right. And if you declare your fellow Muslim to be faithless and he has faith, then you have left the faith. And they pounded away on that time and time and time again. That's how they stayed in power all those years, for those centuries. All right. So that's the first path. So you have the Murajites and the Karajites. And so, you know, the Murajites win the day. Now, having that battle over, then another split developed in the Islamic community between those who believe in defined determinism and those who believe in human free will. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Now, the problem with Islam is that you cannot, there's no resolution to this, really, in the true sense. You know, there is a resolution for this in Christianity because our God is one and three at the same time. You got unity and diversity, form and freedom. You know, you got all those things are ultimately fulfilled in the being of God Himself. You know, there may be mystery for us as to how it works out, but in God it all comes together. Okay, so some questions. Here are some of the questions that, you know, that the early Muslims came up with. Does the omnipotent God predetermine all acts and events, or do humans determine all actions and events? Now, just before we go into this, what would you think? Who do you think won that debate between those two? The divine determinist or the free will?
Determinist.
Yes, you're right. You see where we're going on this, all right? All right. Which of these is it, Allah's decision or is it human decision that determines who is in or out of the Ummah? The free will advocates asserted that demons, not Allah, commit injustices. But the determinist asserted that Allah is responsible for all actions. So you know, you just want to know who won this thing. All right. The Quran, in its inimitable way, supports both positions. Okay. Now, okay, all right. So, you know, Okay, here we go. Okay, say the truth is from your Lord. Let him who will believe, and let him who will reject it do so. Right? For the wrongdoers, we have prepared a fire whose smoke and flames, like the wall and roof of the tent will hem them in. If they implore relief, they will be granted water like melted brass. Oh boy, I'll go drink that. That will scald their faces. How dreadful the drink. How uncomfortable a couch to recline on. So that's the human free will. If you will, you can believe. If you're not, you can believe. You can take it or leave it. That's up to you. All right? Of course, if you leave it, you're going to get burned up when you drink. All right? And here's the divine determinism. It is he then whom the evil of his conduct is made alluring, so that he looks upon it as good, equal one to who is rightly guided. For Allah, here we go. Allah leaves to stray whom he wills and guides whom he wills. You see? So he leads some astray, he guides others. Okay? So let not thy soul go out in vanity, sighing after them, for Allah knows well what they do. So it's all Allah. He there's divine determinism. All right.
Is there anywhere in there the concept of praying for the return of this one who has gone astray?
There might be. I don't know. Okay. Well, obviously, the majority took determinism. I'm sure there is. There may not be a clear teaching about that, but then it depends on
the prayers are set, right?
Right. Everything is set. Actually, Muslims, when they go through their prayer time, they don't really pray. They just recite prayers. And they do all this. Okay. All right. But, that doesn't mean that, you can't pray straight up, But Allah is unknowable. He's aloof. He ain't going to necessarily answer you one way or the other.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so the majority of Muslims then, in that thing, they supported divine determinism. Okay. All right, so you see what's going on. Okay. Now we're going to come to another split. Okay, the Mu'tazilis versus the Asharis. Okay, it's about this time you start having the influence of Greek philosophy. All right, let's look at the Mu'tazilis. Okay, this came along during the Umayyad dynasty. All right, became very strong during the Abbasid dynasty. So it starts in the Umayyad dynasty and becomes strong in the Abbasid dynasty. It developed as a result of the penetration. Here we go of Greek thought into Islam. Now, remember, in the early church, they were wrestling with Neoplatonism and all the rest of that stuff. Okay. All right. The Muslims say that this influence is due to Christian translations of Islamic texts. I'm not exactly sure why they would believe that, but anyway, that's what they say. Maybe, All right. They are influenced by the influx of philosophical thought. Okay, here's what they said. Here's what they did. They use logic a lot. They begin to use a lot of logic, to understand the Quran and that kind of stuff, okay? They use philosophy to interpret the Quran. Okay. They believed in the radical freedom of human will. So in essence, they were rebelling against divine determinism, but they were trying to wrestle with some of these things. All right, here are some of their beliefs. This is what they said. Allah is pure essence. He's incorporeal. Have you had Doctrine of God? Have you studied the incorporeality of God? Okay. Allah is pure essence. And hence, he has no eternal names or qualities. See that? All right. The eternal names and qualities are allegorical. They're all allegorical. Because you can't really say for sure. Because Allah is pure essence. What does that sound like?
Gnosticism.
Yeah. Yeah. A little Plato thrown in, you know. All right. If you believe the 99 names are actual attributes of Allah, then it is shirk. And shirk is blasphemy. All right. Allah cannot do anything that is unreasonable or unjust. He cannot do anything that is unreasonable or unjust. So you see here the ascendancy of reason. It becomes very important. It's the ultimate reference point here, all right? All right, here are some of their beliefs. Reason and revelation are on an equal level. Yes?
I'm getting confused, I think, as we talk about the unknowability of Allah. He's unknowable and he says things, but it's all allegorical and puts up a bunch of smoke and mirrors.
These are the Mutazalis now.
Oh, okay.
They didn't necessarily win the day. Okay. Remember, you got to talk about the Azaris too. Okay.
But how can we believe anything he ever said?
Allah doesn't reveal himself. He just reveals his will.
Okay, so it's just his will.
It's just his will. But again, we're talking about Islam as we understand it today. And in these days, they're wrestling through some of these thoughts, you see. We're looking at development. This is development of Islamic thinking. Okay? All right. So here are some of their beliefs. Reason and revelation are on an equal level. All right? Sounds like some, you know, Pelagius say some of that stuff? Anyway, for the Mu'tazalis, reason was actually functionally higher than revelation, because if you don't understand revelation except through reason, then which is the higher? It's reason, right? Okay, all right. The Quran is created. Now, they started believing in the created Quran. See, there were some of those who did, okay? The Hadith has no authority. Only the Quran does. You see what's happening? You see? So they wanted to throw out the entire Hadith, all right? So we talk about sola scriptura, and we have sola corona. Okay, all right. So forget about the hadith and all that stuff that has no bearing and no value whatsoever. All right. And they wrestled with questions such as how much reason and logic can be used to understand the Islamic faith. Can Allah tell a lie? Here's one. Can Allah make a stone so big that even He can't move it? You know, Christians wrestle with some of those same things too. I remember the first time somebody asked me that question. I was stunned. That was before I understood presuppositionalism. Yeah, so, all right. So, they dealt with stuff like belief, sin, eschatology, government, relationship between faith and works. They dealt with all of this. The relationship between Allah and the Quran. The relationship between predestination and human freedom. Again, they were wrestling with these things, all right? The Mu'tazalis. Okay. All right. What's the political stuff? Okay, guess what? This was used, again. The opposite dynasty used this to justify the Caliphate. They said, well, you know, the opposites, at least in the early days, they were of the Mu'tazali position. Okay, let's look at the Asharis, rather. All right. Obviously, it developed in response to the Mu'tazalis, and the Asharis could be considered the first theologians of Islam. Okay? All right. The Ash'ari school developed Kalam as a separate formal discipline in Islam during this time. Now, again, this isn't the Islam that we see today. We're talking back hundreds of years ago. We're talking about how it developed. We're talking about the development. You know. Now, we're going to come down to what Islam is today. But I'll show you. Okay. All right. So they developed it as a science. All right. Now, this includes the science of Tawheed. You know what Tawheed is? The oneness of God, the oneness of Allah, Tawheed, the oneness of Allah. You hear Muslims talk about that, Tawheed, the oneness. Allah is one and only one. Right. Okay, all right. So, Azari, he used to be a Mu'tazali, but he saw the light, right? So he wanted to create a synthesis. He was trying to create a synthesis between reason and revelation. You know, he saw that the Mutazalis, reason, functionally was higher than revelation. But what he wanted to do is he wanted to synthesize the two, all right? All right. Because, you know, especially, you know, in light of the concept of the absolute sovereignty of Allah. All right. He wanted to also synthesize human freedom and Allah's omnipotence. But you see, he can't do that because of the nature of Allah. Allah is only one. He's one in the finite mathematical concept of one. All right? So here's what he said. If you compromise Allah's omnipotence, then there is no Allah. That's true. But if you discount human free will, then there's no morality. And that's true. All right, so he's trying to work with this stuff. Had Van Til gotten to him, you know, he could have made this. He could have made the jump. Okay, all right. So he borrowed logic from the Mutazalis to discredit their position. All right, and to defend the non-rational aspects of Islam. So for Azhari. Revelation transcended all human reason. So he wanted to put revelation back in its proper place. All right? Okay. So what does he reaffirm? He reaffirms the omnipotence of Allah, the concept of an uncreated Quran, the reality of the names and qualities of Allah. So he says the 99 names are real qualities of Allah. All right. And he reaffirmed divine predestination. Which, if you look at the Islamic concept of divine predestination, it's more like what?
Fatalism.
All right. All right. Here are some of the difficulties with that position. The problem of causality. All right. Here we go. All right. Okay, so horizontal causality. The ball goes into the pool. Why does the ball go into the pool? Because the stick hits it. All right? We all understand that. Okay. Vertical. But each moment of the ball is caused by Allah. So, is it Allah that made the stick go into the pool, or is it, the ball, or was it Allah? Or how do you relate to that, all right? All right, free will. On horizontal, we are free and fully accountable for our actions. Okay? But on the other hand, vertical, determinism, Allah decreed, willed, and created, and acted in every event. But what is it? He never was able to synthesize those. Okay? What caused this? Did Allah do it? It did not. Is Allah responsible for everything, even the evil stuff? Yes, according to Islam today. But then you say, well, how come? But you're not supposed to question. Yes.
I have done a little bit of research into this, and I was wondering about the Ash'ari developed, or Asherism developed, the doctrine of acquisition as kind of a way to resolve this. Now, I think it fails ultimately.
It does.
I wondered if you were going to bring that up. So that
no. I'm, go on.
All right. Well, acquisition basically is saying that Allah determines the events. He determines everything, but we as human beings are free to acquire those events.
Yeah.
And see, what's fascinating about this is that it basically follows the same structure as dialectical theology. There is no, it's a self-destructive dialectic, and there is no solution.
Absolutely. And because of that, because of the problems, mm-hmm. that's why we end up with Islam as it is today. Mm-hmm. And you'll see where we're going with it. Yeah, you're right. Now, there's a group of people called the Salafiyas who are still into that, okay? They believe the Hadith has the same authority as the Quran. Remember I said there are some Muslims who believe it's the Salafiyas, okay? All right. There's a Hadith that says the Prophet did nothing or said nothing that was not inspired by Allah. So, therefore, if the Prophet did all of this stuff, then it's got to have the same weight. Okay. many Gulf Arabs who hate Ikhwan al-Muslimin believe this. And you find some of these folks, you know, around in different parts of the world. They're loosely organized, they're strictly orthodox, they're conservative, they're anti-Western, obviously. And yet, they do have strongholds in North America. There are some of the places, Syracuse, New Jersey, Columbus, Ohio, L.A. All right. So you have some of those people today. All right. They say that nothing is like Allah, yet according to the Quran, guess what? The Quran has these anthropomorphisms. Allah has a hand. All right. Allah has a throne. Okay. All right. Allah. Well, there's several things, you know. All right. Never really worked. It failed. Like I said, I got ahead of myself. He never could synthesize those things very well. Okay. So, but the Azari position came to dominate Sunni Islam for a long time. So between the Mutazilis and the Azaris, the Azaris kind of won the day. Okay. And the Mutazali position was defeated, even with all those difficulties, okay? All right. Now, we're coming to the end. Now, this is all going to make a lot of sense to you, okay? All right. Now, later developments, we go post-1000 AD, up to today. All right. Orthodox scholars then split into two groups. The Azaris and these guys split into two groups. Between the Ahl al-Hadith, the traditionalist, and the Ahl al-Kalam, the theologians. All right. Most Orthodox scholars took the Ahl al-Hadith approach. They went traditional instead of theological. Why? Because, you see, of the difficulties they discovered. All right. And then the Ahl al-Hadith scholars, they split between those who advocated Usul al-Din, theological knowledge, and Usul al-Fiqh, legal knowledge. Remember, Islam is a religion of law. This is how we get to this point with it. And of course, who wins the day? Most of them took the Ahl al-Fiqh position, okay? Legal knowledge. So you see where we're going there. Why? Because Allah and what the Quran says is just not adequate. It's just not. In Christianity, we can relate with somebody. We can wrestle with some of this stuff. And we ultimately, though we have mystery, we know that with God there is no mystery. You know, it ends there. And the being of God. I mean, it comes together. Okay. So then those who took the Usul al-Fiqh position then saw fiqh as having two parts, the divine element, the Quran and Sunnah itself, and the human element, the fixed knowledge, the body of fixed knowledge about the Quran and Sunnah. So which came to dominate? What the Quran says or what others said the Quran says? The human element can be approached. Of course, the human element came in. They came to emphasize the human element. You know, you're not supposed to do any thinking. You're not supposed to do any interpretation. It's already been interpreted. All right? So the human element can be approached in two ways. Subjectively, involving knowledge with understanding, fiqh, or objectively, involving knowledge without understanding, ilm. Who do you think won the day on that one?
Ilm.
Ilm, knowledge without understanding. And that's where we are. So the approach to the human element was reduced to ilm. Thus, all jurisprudence was only on external matters. Now, don't you see why the Sufis came along, okay? Legal knowledge without understanding.
Typo.
The heck, okay, the heck with what you think, the heck, but, you know, where's the typo? Where's the typo?
On the screen.
On the screen. Oh, it's on the screen. Not on the paper. Is
no.
it on the paper?
No, it's on the screen.
Oh, hallelujah. I can tell you. Where?
Understanding.
Understanding.
No view.
Oh, yeah, good night. How did I do that? Well, somebody didn't remind me of something. Glenn Gibson, that's an old friend. I haven't talked to him in 20 years. Hang on, I got to get this. Hey, Glenn.
Hey, man, I'm doing great. Hey, can I call you right back?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm in front of a class teaching them about Islam. Did you hear that I converted? Did you hear that I converted? Did you hear that I became a Muslim? You didn't? Well, you didn't hear because I didn't. Okay, I'm in front of my classroom right now teaching, and they're all laughing here. So normally I don't answer the phone, but since it was you, I decided to answer the phone. I want you to know that you're my special friend, okay? All right, man. I will call you in about 10 minutes. I'll call you back in about 10 minutes. Is that all right? Okay, 30 minutes. That's good. I'll be eating lunch. I'll be feeding my face then. Okay, all right, all right. All right. Okay, Glenn. Okay, brother. Bye-bye. That's a precious brother. I knew him in college, you know, and he was real shy like I was, you know. And we got to talking and I found out he was a brother in Christ. So we just always had a special thing. But I haven't talked to him in a long time. So, in ages. All right, so where are we? Okay, so legal knowledge without understanding. Let's say, so all kalam then was reduced to information science. Kind of like linguistic analysis. That's it. You're not supposed to think. You're not supposed to contemplate. You're not supposed to question. Just memorize it by rote. So when a Muslim scholar gives you knowledge about the Quran and Sunnah, you are forbidden to ask the whys behind it. All right? And if you push the scholar to ask the reason behind the knowledge, what will he say? That's not my problem.
Off of your head.
All right? You know, they'll give you the following advice. Stay with what is clear. Do not look at what is doubtful. It could lead you astray. Don't think! Because it might lead you astray. So, just do it. Rope them. Boom. Boom. Because, see, they got into trouble. They got into trouble, you know, with the Zalis and all that. So, today's Sunni Kalam, in Sunni Kalam, there is no emphasis on understanding. And there's only regurgitation and memorized information. You don't understand Islam unless you understand that. That's why I took you through all that stuff. At one time, Muslims were thinking and trying to speculate and figure things out. But today, it's there. The result is the reduction of kalam to ilm. Sunni kalam has left the arena of the human heart. Human heart has nothing to do with it. All right? And this void can be a great opportunity for the follower of Jesus and the skill of applying the Word of God to core issues. See, you see the opening? So Islam is not that big a deal. We have the tools. All right? Now guess who took over philosophy and theology? It was the Sufis. See, now you see why the Sufis came along. All right. And then finally, to simplify it even further, I just reduced it down to a chart. And this should make it all, the flow chart. This should make it all come together, okay? So, Muslim scholars, you had the Kharijites, the Murajites, who won the day? The Murajites, that led to early Orthodoxy, right? All right, so the early Orthodox scholars split into two groups. Okay, let's lift that up. Lift it up, there you go. Okay, all right. All right, they split into two groups. And here's your dates coming down the side. All right. The Asharis and the Mutazalis. Okay, remember, these are some of the things I said. The reason of the relationship, this is da-da-da-da-da. Blah, 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 blah. Who wins the day? The Asharis. And now you got the Ahl al-Kalam, Ahl al-Hadith. The theologians, the traditionalists. Well, we look with the traditionalists. And then you get the Usul al-Fiqh, Usul al-Din. Legal knowledge versus theological knowledge. Legal knowledge wins the day. All right, we'll lift that up, and then we'll come down to where we are today. And see, like I said, Sunni Islam is just, it's empty. It's empty today. The divine element versus the human element. All right. And of course, everybody went with that. And then was it ilm or fiqh? Objective approach, knowledge without understanding, subjective knowledge with understanding. And of course, that's where Sunni Islam is today.
And most African Americans are Sunni.
But radical Islam connect back to the Kharijite heresy.
Radical Islam, they're into knowledge without understanding, but they But they have taken on a lot of the characteristics, a lot of the teachings of the Karajites. Yeah. So this is my most complicated thing here. Now where was that thing on that typo? Understanding?
Understanding.
It had no U in it?
That's right. Just on your screen.
Okay. Alright. I'll fix that.
Are we done when you do this?
I think it's time for lunch. So what time do we come back? 1:15, is that all right?